The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
All right. Welcome to a Monday. It's a brand new week. It is the 5th of July, and I know that most of my fellow talk show hosts are taking the day off, but I'm not. We're here today. We're live. And, well, this is an important conversation today, as are most of them. Not all of them, but most of them. But today, today's show comes in response to a program I did about a month ago. And maybe it was even a little further back than that, because time sure flies when we're having fun. It was actually May 24th. It was when hostilities between Israel and the Palestinians, you know, basically Hamas and Gaza, were at their worst in a long time. And I wanted to try to make some sense of it. And so I interviewed a man named Norman Finkelstein, who I understood, and my fault, I didn't do enough research on him. I knew he was an Israeli Jew. I knew he was very sympathetic toward the plight of the Palestinians, but I didn't realize. Well, you know what? I'm not even gonna say what his stance is. You can go back and listen to that show from May 24th. You can listen to any of my programs from the past. My show is not behind a paywall. Just go to NicoleSandler.com. In this case, /5-24-21. That's always the format. Or you can put the name of the guest in the search box and it'll come up and you can listen to past shows. Again, there's no paywall on my site because I don't believe in making you pay an admission price to listen to a radio show. I'm old school. So, but I do survive off of your donations. So if you like what you hear and you can afford it, I hope you'll support the program. And there's lots of ways to do that. You can do a one-time donation. You can do a monthly ongoing subscription thing. You can purchase a painting, either have a custom pet portrait done or one of my other paintings. So many ways you can support the show, and I hope you do. But bottom line is, I hope you'll listen today. So after that program back in May with Norman Finkelstein, It hurt. Both listening to what this man was saying, because there was no daylight there. In his mind, to me anyway, it seemed like, you know, Israel bad, Palestinians, Hamas good. And I'm sorry, things aren't that black and white. They just are not. There are many different shades. And I hate to use the term shades of gray anymore after that awful series of books came out, but you know what I'm saying. Nothing is black and white. Nothing is so cut and dry. So I went in search of somebody I could talk to who might be able to shed a more balanced light on what's happening. And sure enough, I came across an article about a book. And the book is called Letters to My Palestinian Neighbor. And it's written by a man named Yossi Klein Halevi. And the more I read about this man, the more impressed I became. And I read some of the letters and some of the letters he got back. And I thought, this is somebody I want to talk to. And I reached out to him. He lives in Israel. And a few days after I sent my first email, he responded very positively. And he said, oh, I'd love to know more about you. Who are you? What's your story? And so we had a little back and forth via email. And he said, I would love to do your show, except he was traveling. So we set a date. And actually, we recorded this on Friday. And I'm telling you that because I want you to know that, yes, this is on tape, but I didn't edit one word. From the moment it begins until the moment it ends, it was taped live, and it airs in that manner. And I want you to hear what he has to say, because hopefully you'll learn, as I did, about the fact that, you know, you can't generalize life. One analogy I made in there rightly or wrongly, was that for the 4 years Trump was in office, I shuddered to think that people around the world were considering all Americans as him, that he spoke for all of us, and we know he did not, right? As embarrassed as I was of him, I know that there are Israelis who felt that way about Netanyahu. So the question is, now that he's gone, are the prospects going to be any better? There's a lot of stuff to get into. So let's not wait any longer. There'll be a few minutes on the other side. It goes fairly long, but I hope you'll be as interested by it as I was and am. I'm going to share this with you. And then on the other side, should you care to weigh in, perhaps, you know, you have a comment to make. I will, if we've got time, open the phone lines. All right. But I'm not going to wait any longer. Let's get right to it. Through the magic of digital audio. Here we go. Yossi Klein Halevi is an American-born Israeli author and journalist who caught my attention last month when we were talking about the problems over between Israel and Palestine. And I sort of stepped in it a bit and I went searching for answers. And I came across some writings about this book, Letters to My Palestinian Neighbor, written by our guests. Yossi, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm really honored to have you here.
Oh, Nicole, delighted to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Now, so you were born in the United States. You're from Brooklyn. And right. In your 20s, decided to move to Israel because you were going home. Was that the reason behind the move?
Very much so. It's not that I felt alienated from my American home. I love America. I was always deeply grateful for everything that America gave to me. But I grew up with this deep sense of awareness that I was privileged to be living at a time when the Jewish people was recreating itself in its ancient home. And this was a dream that Jews had carried for 2,000 years of exile. And it was fulfilled just before I was born. I was part of the first generation that was born into the reality of a Jewish state. And so I felt this sense of privilege and responsibility. And I mean privilege, not in the way it's used today politically right. In the discourse. I mean in the old-fashioned sense of I truly was privileged to be a part of Jewish history at this moment. When the greatest dream of the Jewish people was being fulfilled. And what happened in Israel was so important to me, even as I was growing up in America. I followed the news closely, and I felt that Israel didn't only belong to Jews who had nowhere else to run. Israel was not only a refuge, Israel belonged in some sense to the whole Jewish people. And even though I was privileged to be born in America and to live in the most successful and safe and prosperous Jewish diaspora in our history, my heart was there from the very beginning. And so eventually I dragged my body over to the Middle East and I've been living there for 40 years.
So this is your home. You are, like I said at the beginning, an American-born Israeli now. And yes. You find yourself in the middle of, well, this ongoing conflict. It came to fore last month because hostilities grew once again between Palestinians and Gaza and the Israeli government. And I'll say right up front, there's no easy solution to this. If there were, we wouldn't be in this boat. You've obviously been living with this, among this, for all these years. And you are a journalist and an author. You write op-eds. You're involved in this discussion. And a few years back, you came out with a book that we're talking about now, Letters to My Palestinian Neighbor. Can you explain what the book is and why you decided to write this?
The book is a series of 10 extended letters to an anonymous Palestinian neighbor, literally on the next hill from where I'm speaking to you now. I live in a neighborhood in Jerusalem called French Hill, in the very last row of houses, which is to say the border of between Jerusalem and the West Bank.
Wow.
On the next hill, I look out onto two Palestinian villages. We are separated by the security barrier that was built during the wave of suicide bombings about 15 years ago. And so I live with the conflict as my landscape. I wake up, I see the wall. I hear the muezzin, the Palestinian, the call to prayer. Mm-hmm. I look out at my neighbors on the next hill, but I have no connection with them, or had no connection with them. And so I wrote this book for two reasons. One is to try to explain to my neighbors who I am as an Israeli, as a Jew, living here on the next hill, why I'm here, why the Jewish people came home, why we believe this is home, a home that we share with another people, with the Palestinians. So that was the first purpose. And the second purpose of this book was to invite Palestinians to respond. This is my narrative. This is my story. Write to me. Let me know what you think, whether you agree with what I wrote, whether you passionately disagree, and tell me your narrative. What's your story? And the book has been downloaded in Arabic by about 5,000 people.
Okay.
I've received hundreds of letters in response, ranging from deeply hostile to deeply empathic. And in the next edition of the book, the paperback edition, which is what you have up here on the screen, I included in an epilogue some of the best responses that I had received from Palestinians. So the book now ends with a 50-page epilogue of letters from Palestinians to their Israeli neighbor. And this was my second intention, was to try to model what a respectful disagreement over contrasting narratives might actually sound like. And if Palestinians and Israelis can start speaking to each other about narratives of life and death with which we so deeply disagree, then my hope is that maybe this book and the Palestinians who responded to this book can help model a respectful disagreement in other situations, maybe even in America, maybe even as unbelievable as it is to imagine, between Democrats and Republicans.
Oh boy. That's a heavy lift.
Existential divides, right?
Right. No kidding. But so you're saying that in all your years living in Israel, you realize that you know the Palestinians' claim to the land that is now known as Israel, or known to Israelis as Israel, that they consider Palestine. But you said, from what you've learned, most Palestinians don't understand the Jews' claim to the land that is Israel. And so you wanted to tell your story, our story, right? And I say our because I'm an American of Jewish heritage, as I explained to you in the letter. I'm not religious, but I do come from a Jewish background, and heritage is very important in our lives. Was this your intent, to try to explain to them the reason you feel, and Israelis feel, that Israel is your land, that yes, Israelis are indigenous to this, yes, area?
Very much so. That this, the tragedy of this conflict, from my perspective, is not that it's between right and wrong, but it's between right and right. Mm. It is between two indigenous peoples, both wounded peoples, each people wounded in a different way by history, and two peoples who are fated to live together and will need to accommodate each other's legitimate national claims. And so the purpose of this book was really twofold: to explain myself to my neighbors and invite my neighbors to explain themselves to me, because that's the only way this is going to work. There cannot be a one-way explanation this is my story, and I want you to understand it. Yes, this is my story, and I want you to understand it with the caveat that you also have a story, and I need to listen and understand. And, you know, Nicole, the hardest decision that I had to make with this book, and maybe one of the most difficult decisions that I've ever had to make as a writer, was what to do with the Palestinian letters that I received in response to this book. Mm-hmm. Now, I knew that I would include them in the new edition of the book. But do I give the Palestinian counter-narrative the final word in my book? Or do I respond in the book and try to say, no, you're wrong about that. You know, you've misread the history on this point, which is a very natural tendency when you're engaged in a polemic.
Right.
But I didn't want this book to be a polemic. And so in the end, I decided to not only publish the Palestinian counter-narrative in my book, but to give them the last word and not respond. I've responded personally to each of them. But in the book, I honor them with the last word. And I'm hoping in that way to signal to my Palestinian neighbors that I'm serious about a respectful conversation, and also to hopefully model what that might sound like in other situations.
Right. Now, I should mention that you have offered the book as a free download in Arabic. So
yes,
for your neighbors in the Arab world, they can download it for free. It won't cost them anything. I should also tell you that I discovered, perchance, by going to Amazon, that the Kindle edition right now is available for $1.99. So,
oh wow,
yes,
that's very bad news for writers.
I'm sure it is, but for those who really want to take a look at it, and it says this is temporary. I don't know why they lowered it, but I took advantage of that. There's also a website, letterstomyneighbor.com, where you tell the story. You share some. You have the Arabic download page. You have and some of the letters, and a way for readers to respond. So,
right, and it's in English and Arabic.
In English and Arabic, yeah. Because the goal is to get this out to your Arab neighbors. So, yes. Now, all right, Yossi Klein Halevi, I read some of the book, I read some of the responses, and they're all very heartfelt. Some are, you know, you don't know what you're talking about, this is my history, and here's mm-hmm. where it stands, but others are encouraged by you wanting to open a dialogue. Now, I also saw an interview with you in which you were asked, so then why is it published in English and why is it released here in the United States? And you said something about reaching out to maybe young American Jews. Well, you know what? I'm not so young, but I am an American Jew who's very conflicted over this. And it hurts my heart when I see the bombing going on, and I see the death and destruction, and I hate what Israel is doing, and I hate what Hamas is doing. But I realize that the Palestinians, the people who are now living on Gaza and in the West Bank, whose settlements are encroaching on them every day, that they're rights are being violated. And so I want to know your story. I would like to know what I can tell to critics, to people who say Israel is the evil empire, why Israel should exist, why it deserves to exist, and why the Jews have a homeland there. So can you give us, I mean, it's a big undertaking, but can you give us the Reader's Digest version?
Right. Well, my Twitter version of an answer is Israel deserves to exist because it does exist. And Israel should not be the only country in the world that has to continually prove its right to exist. That, to me, is a double standard that has very disturbing echoes in Jewish history. Mm-hmm. Jews are used to being treated to a double standard, and now the Jewish state is being subjected to a double standard. And so there tends to be a conflation between opposition to certain Israeli policies with Israel's right to exist. And there's no other country in the world that I can think of that is subjected to the same treatment as Israel is, where we so easily go from condemning policies of that government to questioning whether the country itself has a right to exist. Now, that's something that I, as an Israeli, and I, as a Jew, will not debate. I will not defend my right to exist. The argument about whether Israel should have come into existence or not was a legitimate debate up until May 14th, 1948, which was the day that Israel was declared a state. The moment Israel came into existence, its legitimacy was based on the fact that it had joined the family of nations. Now, the fact that Israel defended itself from an invasion by seven Arab countries who attacked Israel the day that it was born, trying to destroy it. The fact that Israel has been in an ongoing war to defend its legitimacy from the day of its existence has complicated our reality. It has forced us into a position to some of our policies are policies that I see as legitimate expressions of self-defense. Others, like expanding settlements, I consider to be counterproductive. But this is a conflict that requires nuance. It requires a little bit of care on both sides to try to really understand what we're dealing with here. And instead, what we have are strident slogans that Israel is apartheid, Israel is colonialist, Israel is ethnic cleansing. You know, I live in a building. I'm speaking to you now from my apartment in a building which is almost 50% Arab-Israeli, 50% Jewish-Israeli. When I step out of my home, I enter into a Hebrew-Arabic environment. This has nothing to do with apartheid. Now, this conflict is about many things, and there's lots of injustice in this conflict. There's lots of injustice that this existential conflict has generated. But it is not apartheid. It is not ethnic cleansing. The simplistic slogans that are used to undermine Israel's legitimacy are just outrageous. And it only makes peace all the more elusive, because what it does is send a message to Israelis that we are never going to be heard, we're going to be demonized, we're evil, as you put it, the evil empire. Well, you don't make peace with an apartheid, racist, colonialist state, you destroy it. That's what happened to Rhodesia, that's what happened to South Africa, Nazi Germany. Well, is Israel that? That's certainly not the Israel that I live in. It is the fantasy Israel of anti-Zionists, but it has very little resemblance to the real country that I live in. Now, the country that I live in is very complicated, and there's lots going on here that I want to see change. But that's very different than saying that this country has no right to exist. That the goal is not two states, but one big state in which the Jews are going to be reduced to a minority status again. We're not going back there. The Jewish people is not going back to minority status in this country. And so the anti-Zionist fantasy narrative of this conflict only exacerbates tensions, only forces Israelis more deeply into a siege mentality. And you can't make peace from that place.
Right. So now the question, the big question that seems to be changing over the years is, how do we fix it? And the general consensus, I think, among most people is a two-state solution. You've said that's the only thing that will work, but it won't work. I'm probably misquoting you. What did you mean by that, or something similar to that?
Well, what I tried to say was that I dread a two-state solution because I frankly don't trust the Palestinian leadership. I see what happened in Gaza when Israel withdrew from Gaza. We got thousands of rockets on Israeli towns along the border. And I'm very worried, as are most Israelis, about what would happen if we withdrew from the West Bank. Your listeners can't see it, but I'm pointing now across the way to the West Bank, to Palestine. It's literally on the next hill. Now, if we withdraw and a Palestinian state is created on the next hill, will that be a peaceful state ready to accept the legitimacy of Israel in these borders? Or will it turn into another Gaza? Will Hamas take over? So I'm very worried about a two-state solution. Israel is a very small place.
Yes.
You know, it's very hard for Americans to imagine this, but we live with an intimate geography. If we withdraw from the West Bank, Israel will be 8 miles wide.
Wow, 8 miles.
Narrowest point.
Wow.
8 miles wide.
Mm-hmm.
And so there really is a, there's a deep fear that many of us have here. Most Israelis have toward a Palestinian state. The only thing that I fear more than a two-state situation is the absence of a two-state solution.
There you go.
Because if we don't have a Palestinian state eventually, Israel will continue to be a long-term occupier of the Palestinians. We will be losing our identity either as a Jewish majority state or as a democracy. And if Israel stops being a Jewish and democratic state, it's not Israel anymore. Mm-hmm. It's not the Israel that I move to. Israel must maintain its identity as, on the one hand, the continuity of 4,000 years of Jewish history, as a safe refuge for the Jewish people, as a country that is responsible for Jews around the world. That's one facet of our identity. The other facet is we must remain a democratic state that belongs to all of its citizens, whether or not they are Jews. That means that we can't have a long-term situation where several million Palestinians are living in limbo, where they're not citizens.
Right.
And so with all of the deep fear that I have for a Palestinian state, in the end, I affirm the necessity, for Israel's sake, of a two-state solution. But it's really important, I think, for Americans to understand that this is not easy for Israelis to come to. This is not, it's, you know, there's a tendency among outsiders to say, why don't you just solve the damn conflict already? Well, when I look at the experience we've had with Gaza, I have to ask myself 100 times over, am I really ready to risk the possibility of Gaza literally 500 meters from my porch?
Okay,
if the West Bank becomes a Palestinian state, will it become another Gaza? But in other words, what I'm trying to say, Nicole, is that our dilemma is not simple.
No.
We don't have good solutions. There are no good solutions facing Israel. And so what I ask of outsiders is, yes, condemn us when we deserve to be condemned, but understand that being the only non-Arab, non-Muslim state in the Middle East, which is one of the most dangerous and volatile regions on the planet, creates a built-in danger for Israel.
Sure.
And I'm responsible as a citizen of Israel. I'm the custodian of the fulfillment of a very old dream. It's an ancient dream. And I have to be very careful with Israel's security. At the same time, I also have to be mindful of the fact that I have neighbors and I can't keep them permanently under occupation. And so I need to be moving toward a two-state solution. But it's not easy and it's not simple.
That's an understatement. So let me ask you this. The most recent round of hostilities, for lack of a better term, began in nearby where you live, right? There was an East Jerusalem neighborhood that was where Palestinians have lived for generations, and the Israelis came in and were trying to evict them and put in another settlement. This is what sparked the latest round of ugliness. You know, I've been of the mind for the last dozen years or so that a big part of the problem was Benjamin Netanyahu, much the same way as I felt during the 4 years under Trump. Don't hate all of us. Hate him. You know, he right? But don't hate all of us. We don't all follow his insanity. So now Netanyahu's out, and in its place, this big coalition of groups further to the right and even the first Arab members of the Knesset, if I have that right. Again, I'm an observer. So do we have hope that things are going to get better under this new coalition of leaders in Israel? Or what's the situation there now?
I'll tell you, Nicole, one thing that I learned from my years in Israel is always have hope and always expect things to get worse at the same time. Mm. And both expectations tend to be vindicated by the reality here. In terms of this government, I think this is a really extraordinary experiment. It is not only composed of right-wing parties, there are also left-wing parties and centrist parties. It is not only Jewish parties, but an Arab party, an Arab party that is also an Islamist party.
Wow.
It is a party of the Muslim Brotherhood. So this is an experiment to bring opposites around the table. And there's something, I think, quintessentially Israeli in the extraordinary diversity of this government. I pray that it holds together. This government, I think, sends out a very important message, not only to Israel and not only to Israeli Jews and Israeli Arabs, but there's a message here, I think, for dysfunctional political systems around the world where political rivals won't even speak to each other, let alone sit together in the same government. So there is something very hopeful about this moment. In terms of the Sheikh Jarrah situation, which you referred to earlier, the situation is a little more complicated than that. Although in the end, my judgment is against Israel on this particular issue. But to play it out a little bit, it's true that you have Palestinian families that have lived in these houses. But before the creation of Israel in 1948, these actually were houses that were owned by Jewish families who were expelled by the Jordanians who occupied East Jerusalem after 1948 and gave those houses to these Palestinian families. So here again, it's you know, when you widen the lens, it starts to look a little more complicated. There were Jewish families who actually were expelled from these homes. Right. Now there are Jews who want these homes back. So legally, the Jewish claimants are right. Nevertheless, I believe that it's wrong to expel these families after several generations, and there needs to be another solution. So in the end, I would say that Israel's argument is legally right, but morally problematic.
That's the conundrum. That's the whole conundrum in that region. I want to ask
over and over again.
History repeats itself. I want to ask about Gaza because I've gotten some kickback from listeners when I refer to Hamas as a terrorist organization. Hamas is not the Palestinian population that lives in Gaza. Can you explain the difference? Who Hamas is and why? You can separate them from the general population there?
Hamas, first of all, is a dictatorship. Mm-hmm. They allow no dissent. they violently took over from the Palestinian Authority. People from the rival Palestinian groups were thrown off of high-rise rooftops in Gaza City. And that's Hamas. Hamas is violent not only against Israelis, but against their own people. There is no dissent tolerated in Gaza. And I can't for the life of me understand how progressive Westerners who would never tolerate the kinds of misogynist, anti-LGBTQ attitudes, repression that we see on the part of the Hamas government in Gaza, they would never tolerate it in their own lives, but somehow it's okay for Palestinians to live under that kind of regime. So that's before we even get to Israel. Mm-hmm. Is Hamas a terrorist group? Well, Hamas's war against Israel basically consists of two tactics. One is suicide bombings in Israeli restaurants, cafes, on Israeli buses. And the other is firing rockets into Israeli neighborhoods indiscriminately. Now, Israel has gotten a tremendous amount of blame and criticism for civilian casualties who were not deliberately killed by Israel. Israel made tremendous efforts to try to minimize civilian casualties on the Palestinian side, if for no other reason than that we know that we're going to get blamed, that we're going to be on the defensive. And so it's in Israel's interest to minimize civilian casualties. It is in Hamas's interest to maximize civilian casualties on the Israeli side. Mm-hmm. Hamas is waging a war explicitly aimed at the Israeli civilian population. Israel is waging a war at Hamas forces who are embedded in a civilian population. Now, I don't understand why that asymmetry isn't acknowledged. Now, I understand, yes, Israel has much more power than Hamas. And I understand the tendency on the part of people to say, well, this isn't a fair fight. But there's something a little bit skewed about indulging a terrorist group that oppresses their own people, that denies Israel's right to exist, that is explicitly committed to the destruction of Israel. And then to say when Israel defends itself against rocket attacks, it's not a fair fight because the Israelis have more power. Right. So what would make it a more fair fight? Should we do what Hamas does, which is indiscriminately fire rockets into Gaza? Would that be more fair? Wow. I don't understand the moral calculation here. And so the whole victim terminology here of American progressive discourse distorts history. It certainly in the case of the conflict that I live, when you turn Israel into the arch villain of this story, you need to do two things. First of all, you need to minimize the threats that Israel lives with, the security threats. And you also need to ignore the fact that over the decades, Israel repeatedly offered the Palestinian leadership a two-state solution, which the Palestinian leadership ignored.
Right. And this is not, for some reason, people don't hear that. That is a fact. But nobody seems to acknowledge it.
And so if you're going to turn Israel into the evil bully, you have to ignore the fact that we actually tried to end the occupation and we did not have a peace partner. Now, that has not been true. You mentioned Netanyahu before.
Yes.
Under the Netanyahu reign, Israel has not offered the Palestinians a credible two-state solution. And that's been true now for the last 10, 12 years.
Right.
But I have to tell you, in all honesty, I don't believe that even if we had a left-wing government in Israel today, I don't believe that we would have a partner in the Palestinian leadership for a two-state solution. I don't believe that there are Palestinian leaders still who are ready to accept the legitimacy of a Jewish majority state in any border. Mm-hmm. And so one of the reasons that I wrote this book is that I'm trying to bypass the political leadership on both sides and go straight to the Palestinian people and say, listen, we are living in an age of social media. Let's start communicating. Mm-hmm. Here's my book. It's I've translated it into Arabic. It's available for free downloading. Here's my website. Send me a letter. I don't need Netanyahu and Mahmoud Abbas to make peace. Let's start making peace. Let's start talking.
Right.
And so that's and you know, Nicole, I'm just a writer.
Uh-huh.
I'm not a diplomat. I'm not a leader. I'm not a politician. This is all I can do, is I work with words. And so here are my words. Give me your words. Let's start a conversation.
And the conversation has begun. You know, some years ago, I reached out to a man who's since left us, Yuri Avnery, who was a peace activist in Israel, who famously met with Yasser Arafat back when that wasn't happening. And to the day he died in his 90s, this was his quest. I have so much respect for him, and I enjoyed a couple of conversations with him. And, you know, it seems to me that
he was a legendary figure.
I'll bet. So, and it seems like he founded Gush Shalom, which is this peace movement, which I'm afraid is not very widespread, but has a great vision. And it seems to me that, and I could be wrong, but it seems to me like you're in that mold, that you want to foster peace, that you want to talk to your neighbors. And judging from what I'm reading, you're getting response. Now, you mentioned earlier, you're not looking to one-up anyone, that you had in your story. You talk about the Jews being indigenous to this region, that they were there 4,000 years ago. And one responder wrote to you and said, well, the Palestinians were here 6,000 years ago. And you're like, I wanted to respond, but I just let it. I didn't, because I guess you're not trying to convince anybody of anything. Just open the lines of dialogue.
Yeah, I think that you put it very well there. We Palestinians and Israelis don't discuss our narratives. We engage in gladiator combat, where each side tries to erase the legitimacy of the other narrative. Now, I have to tell you that I'm not in the camp of Uri Avnery, okay, who you mentioned earlier. Gush Shalom is really on the far left,
okay,
of Israeli discourse. I don't come from that place. I'm very much in the mainstream, in the center of Israeli discourse, which means that I Uri Avnery would have placed most of the blame for the failure of peace on the Israeli side.
Okay.
I think there's enough blame to go around, and I certainly don't place all or most of the blame on my side. I own up to much of the blame, but by no means all of it.
Gotcha. Now, but you know, the fact that there's a new program out. It's on one of the pay services on Netflix or one of them, called Oslo. That is a dramatization of these talks between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And look, I'm not a kid, but I was never truly educated on what happened there. I hope people will watch it. It's, like I said, it's on one of those pay services, simply called Oslo, and it's fascinating. And obviously the talks broke down, but you saw these people who were just vehemently opposed to one another come down to a human place to try to make this human connection and try to make peace. Is something like that even possible anymore?
You know, what gives me hope is what's happening in the wider region. We used to say in Israel that peace will happen from within outward. And by that, we meant that first peace has to happen with the Palestinians, which is the inner core of the conflict, and then Israel will make peace with the Arab world. Now we are speaking about peace happening from without inward. First, Israel is finding its place in the wider region, and then hopefully with our new Arab allies, we'll be able to start figuring out the security and economic components of a successful Palestinian state. And I think we can only achieve that if we work together with the Gulf states, with Saudi Arabia, with Egypt and Jordan. And this is really flipping on its head the old notion of how peace is going to happen. And what we've seen is that for all kinds of reasons, peace between Israelis and Palestinians is too difficult at this moment to achieve. But we are seeing tremendous progress happening in the region. And that gives me a great deal of hope. And I'm in touch regularly with people all over the region. And so that's something that I think can contribute long term, if only to help Israelis feel less under siege and more willing to take a chance on a Palestinian state. And this is something also that's very important for outsiders to understand about the Israeli mindset, which is when Israelis feel unfairly condemned, when we feel demonized, when all the blame is placed on us, even when we're trying to defend ourselves against a terrorist dictatorship, then the Israeli response is to turn even more rightward.
Right.
To raise the walls, to circle the wagons. And that's a natural response, and it's especially the case in the Jewish psyche for historical reasons. The way in which to get Israelis to be receptive to the possibility of a two-state solution is not to boycott us, it's to embrace us. Hmm. It's to help Israelis feel part of the Middle East, and then to challenge Israelis. And that's what I'm trying to do in this book. I'm trying to challenge Palestinians to face the fact that the Israelis are not an alien white colonialist invasion, but an indigenous people, a majority of whom come from Jewish communities that never left the Middle East,
wow,
that went from one part of the Middle East and came to Israel. We came from Yemen and Iraq and Iran and Morocco and Egypt, and as well as Poland and Russia, and in my case, America.
Right.
We've come from all over the world, but a majority of the Israeli population comes from families that either fled or were expelled from Arab countries, from ancient Jewish communities. So what I'm challenging the Palestinian reader of this book is to come to terms with the fact that we are not some alien transplant, but a re-indigenized people. And what I'm challenging the Israeli reader of this book is, what's our vision of the future? Do we really see the status quo as sustainable another generation or two? What do we need to do to offer our Palestinian neighbors some hope? We are the stronger side here. Mm. And even though we've been under siege in the Middle East, we've been alone in the Middle East, we are still the stronger party toward the Palestinians. So what's our responsibility here? And so what I'm really trying to do is make everyone a little bit uncomfortable.
Good.
And come to terms with the complexity of the conflict.
It's so important what you're doing, this conversation that you've opened and having is so important, because we need to talk, and we need to get the governments out of the equation and let us talk human being to human being. Right. I got one more question for you that is just something that I a curiosity for me. Gaza, yes, is bordered by Israel on one side, but it also has a border with Egypt, and Egypt it maintains the blockade. Egypt doesn't let Palestinians flow in and out, or goods and services, right? Am I wrong on that?
Absolutely, absolutely. But you see, when you mention that inconvenient fact, it complicates the narrative and it doesn't serve the anti-Israel purpose.
Right.
And so that's ignored.
Yeah.
And the question here is, why does Egypt as well as Israel feel the need to be blockading Gaza? And it's not to punish the Palestinians. It's to keep Iranian weapons out of the hands of Hamas.
Wow.
Now, somehow that gets totally lost, and this becomes some fantasy play of an evil Israel gratuitously, for no reason, trying to suppress the Palestinians. That's not what's happening here. And I believe we have to find a different way. This is a dead end. We need to start thinking of new solutions, but let's not simplistically judge one side or the other.
Okay.
And I don't hold all Palestinians responsible for Hamas. And let's start humanizing this conversation.
I believe you've started that. Let's continue it. Again, the book is Letters to My Palestinian Neighbor by Yossi Klein Halevi. Again, you can buy it. You can get it on the Kindle. You can get it in now paperback form with some of the letters that you've received back from people. And you mentioned all these other countries where Jews have settled, from Iran and Iraq and Yemen and Jordan and on and on. And you've gotten letters from people in all of those countries. Many of them are represented on the website, letterstomyneighbor.com. I encourage everyone to read it and just open your mind and realize that it's not all black and white, that there are a lot of shades of gray, and that we need to learn how to talk to one another as human beings and stop with the narratives and the war of narratives. Yossi Klein Halevi, thank you so much. This has been really eye-opening for me, and just a pleasure to listen to you speak. Thank you
Nicole. I've so much enjoyed engaging with you. Thanks for the opportunity.
There you go. So a conversation with Yossi Klein Halevi. We recorded that on Friday, airing it for you today. And as I said, I didn't edit the conversation at all. That's how it unfolded. And if nothing else, I hope it just spurs more questions or makes you say, you know what, I'd like to connect personally with people that are supposed, I hate to use the word enemies, but not necessarily my friends in ideology. I know some of us try it over here with Republicans, doesn't always work so well, but he's trying something very different. I mean, you heard the situation too. So he lives in East Jerusalem, which is, an area that is in question, because some of the plans for a two-state solution call for East Jerusalem to be part of Palestine. It borders on the West Bank. He's right. He said he can see that settlement where the Israelis were coming into the neighborhood where Palestinians have lived for, in some cases, generations, to try to put down more settlements and evict them. That's what started this latest round of war, the latest rockets going back and forth. And he even said, look, I'm not going to place all the blame, but I think, for the most part, Israel's got this one in terms of their fault here. But we're not talking about something like the United States that, 245 years old this week. We're talking about the oldest, most ancient part of the world where these peoples have been living for centuries, for millennia. And there is no right, no wrong. Somebody in the chat room kept saying, yeah, but why are the Jews trying to steal the land from Gaza? And to you, all I say is go back and listen, like really listen to the conversation, and maybe read up on history. Because I'll tell you, I'm not the most knowledgeable historian out there. But even I know, you can't say, no, it's the Jews. No, it's the Palestinians. They were all there for thousands of years. And what my guest was saying is, we all have a right to be here. So, again, I didn't expect that this conversation would give us any answers, but maybe open our minds a little more. Because what he said that really rang true for me is, it blows my mind, and I'm paraphrasing, obviously, these are my words, not his, that the American progressive community is so quick to defend Hamas. Well, or as he puts it, Hamas. That's how they say it there. Hamas is not the Palestinian people. They're the ones who've taken over that territory. And you know what? Hamas may rule Gaza, but it doesn't rule the West Bank. And that's what he was saying, was his worry that if all of a sudden this two-state solution comes in and the West Bank, those lands are given back to the Palestinians, does Hamas come in and take over? And those are the things we don't know. But to just give them free rein, it's, again, it's not black or white. There are all these different shades of gray. And, you know, I love his, the thing that attracted me to his book that made me want to talk to this man was the premise of this book he wrote. You know, letters to my Palestinian neighbor who I don't know. So I'm looking at the website. It's letterstomyneighbor.com. And there's a section of reader responses. And I'm just going to pick one at random. And just know that they're not all as open-minded and complimentary. Here's one from, all right, from somebody in Morocco. A response from Ayub from Morocco. And it's, hold on, caller, I'll get to you in a second. This letter, and it's too long, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it starts off by saying, Mr. Yossi Klein Halevi, I send you my warmest greetings. At the very outset of my letter, I would like to express my deep appreciation and gratefulness for the bravery and mental effort it must have taken you to write each and every line of your letters. Your work is not only valuable in the context it seeks to impart, but also by virtue of the accuracy and honesty of its writing. And it goes on here. As a young person, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict only initially caught my attention when the Second Intifada erupted. The news of the victims of both sides, replete with heartbreaking pictures, were circulated everywhere during these times. I could never understand what exactly each side was fighting to achieve. All possible motives struck me as meaningless or unsubstantiated. Throughout the years, I not only sought to avoid taking a position on such matters, but rather refused to try to understand what was going on in the first place. These events never meant anything to me. I only hoped to never see those heartbreaking pictures again. And it goes on. This is a long, long letter, and Yossi's response is included too. So I invite you to go by yourself, to go yourself in letterstomyneighbor.com. I see we've got a call, someone from the LA area. It looks like. Hi, who's this?
Lynn from LA.
Hey, West Lynn. LA. Hi.
Hi. Just wanted to say I appreciate how you try to keep an open mind and investigate all sides to issues. And I thought I would share with you something I got off of a Progressive Democrats of America meeting, which opened my mind.
Okay.
And maybe you would enjoy it. It's a movie called The Occupation of the American Mind, and you can find it at occupationmovie.org.
Okay. Occupationmovie.org. That's all
I just wanted to share that view. It opened my mind to it.
Oh, cool.
Yet another side. So,
very,
enjoy.
I will check it out. Thank you for calling. I appreciate it.
Love your show.
Thank you so much.
Bye now.
All right. Bye-bye. All right. And with that, we are out of time for the day. I got in one call. I got to read part of a letter. I hope you enjoyed the interview. And as much as I would like to see Mr. Halevi get paid, you know, for his books, right now, as I discovered purely by chance, on Amazon, the Kindle version of the book is $1.99. If you want to read it, that's a good way to do it. Or if you don't want to spend the money, go to letterstomyneighbor.com and explore a bit. Read some of the responses he got. opening our minds. That's what it's all about. Instead of going into something with a situation with blinders on, how about we look to understand what the other guy is thinking? Just an idea. All right. Thanks for listening, everyone. We're done for the day. I'll see you tomorrow. Gotta Laugh will be here. All right. Now, it looks like, okay. Well, Progressive Voices is in the news, so why don't we end with the news, all right? And I'll see you tomorrow again with Laffy, and hopefully we'll have a few laughs, that is. Thanks, everyone.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
This year, the 4th of July is a day of special celebration, for we are emerging from the darkness of a year of pandemic and isolation, a year of pain, fear, and heartbreaking loss. Just think back to where this nation was a year ago. Think back to where you were a year ago, and think about how far we've come.
President Biden and First Lady Jill Biden hosted a 4th of July celebration at the White House on Sunday with a barbecue for military families and essential workers. Biden thanked both groups for their service. He said the country was celebrating independence from the virus as cases fall and vaccinations rise. The country did fall short of Biden's goal to get 70% of adults at least one dose of a coronavirus vaccine by Independence Day. The final figure stands at about 67%. Dr. Fauci said about 50% of the U.S. population is fully vaccinated against COVID-19. But unvaccinated pockets of the country remain extremely vulnerable, and the holiday weekend will likely make things worse. The South, Southwest, and parts of the Midwest are again seeing surges. Florida alone accounts for about 17% of all new cases in the U.S., and more than 99% of those deaths from COVID in June in the U.S. were among people who were not vaccinated. 99%. Well, it's that time of year again. Tropical storm Elsa, with top sustained winds at about 60 miles per hour, sideswiped the southern coast of Hispaniola, leaving two dead in the Dominican Republic over the weekend and hitting Haiti with high winds and heavy rains. Another person died on the island of St. Lucia when the storm crashed through the Lesser Antilles on Friday. It's expected to keep building and be back near hurricane strength as Elsa approaches Cuba on Monday. Cuba already evacuated more than 180,000 people threatened by possible flooding and other storm damage. And then the storm's track is expected to shift north, with Elsa's outer bands forecast to reach the Florida Keys on Monday and continue north toward a possible landfall near Tampa early Wednesday. With the storm brewing, search crews in Surfside, Florida, the site of the collapsed condo building, paused their efforts on Saturday and shifted to a rushed demolition. County officials had planned to have the building torn down later, but concerns about the storm forced them to speed up the timetable. So, demolition experts tore down the rest of the partially collapsed Champlain Tower South condominium in Surfside, Florida, early Sunday morning. Almost immediately, cranes started moving again on the debris pile as rescue crews resumed their work. They say they may actually be able to access more areas in the rubble now because of the demolition. And sure enough, on Monday morning, three more bodies were discovered. The death toll now stands at 27, with about 118 people still missing and unaccounted for. Well, lots of us hit the roads over the Independence Day weekend, so traffic was snarled everywhere. But you've got to have some extra sympathy for the motorists stuck on a section of I-95 in Massachusetts on Saturday. The freeway was closed as a police standoff with a group of heavily armed men from a militia group known as the Rise of the Moors continued for more than 9 hours. When it all ended, 11 of the men were arrested and in custody. The incident began around 1:30 a.m. Saturday morning after a state trooper saw two cars pulled over on 95 with their hazard lights on and men refilling their gas tanks with their own fuel. The officer then realized they were wearing military-style uniforms and carrying guns. One of the members of the militia was live streaming on YouTube during the events and claimed the group was not hostile.
The police seen us on the side of the road. with our guns secured. We were afraid, so we got out with our arms.
They wanted to be heard. A variety of, not demands, but requests that they just be allowed to leave the area, transit the area, without any accountability. And at the end of the day, we couldn't accommodate that.
So the former guy is at it again. Trump hosting a rally in Sarasota, Florida on Saturday night, during which he addressed the recent fraud and conspiracy charges filed against the Trump Organization and its chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg.
They go after good, hardworking people for not paying taxes on a company car. Company car. You didn't pay tax on the car or a company apartment. You used an apartment because you need an apartment because you have to travel too far where your house is and didn't pay tax. Or education for your grandchildren. I don't even know. Do you have to? But does anybody know the answer to that stuff? Okay? But they indict people for that.
Amazing. Aside from the indictment, Trump also repeated false claims of widespread voter fraud in the 2020 election, and he left the door open for a run in 2024, but again stopped short of a definitive answer, obviously so he can keep bilking his supporters for yet more money. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.